Okay, great. What we do is, and for those that might not be familiar with what we do briefly, is HMTRI has been around since about 1987. Our main interest is helping communities develop environmental job training programs. We also work with community colleges. We're associated with community colleges, develop credit and non-credit environmental and energy programs. The work we are doing with EPA is essentially assisting and facilitating communities to develop job training programs with or without federal funds. They might be with foundation funds or they might be with state funds. We've had over 100 grantees go through the program, which is really a small number because that's about 10% of the number of brownfield federally funded programs. Plenty of room to grow. There's thousands of federally funded cleanup and assessment and underground storage tank facilities, and the whole idea is let's try to put the indigenous population, people who have been victimized by the environmental degradation, let's try to get them to work at these facilities and share in some of the jobs that are being created. And of course, the traditional reason for not doing this is the people in the community aren't trained and they're not suited for the job. So in response, EPA initiated a program, and this is why it's an EPA and not Department of Labor, initiated a program to train people specifically in environmental skills so that they could complement and they can work with the infrastructure improvements and grants that are given out by various agencies to get the jobs that are being created in that community. Unfortunately, the program is very small. It's only a few million dollars a year. They usually give 10 to 12 grants a year. Our job isn't necessarily to prep people for the grants. We really are interested in trying to help people develop sustainable, high-quality, efficient programs. Interestingly enough, in our process of developing our methodology in terms of developing a good job training program, EPA has kind of adopted our issues as their grading criteria and their ranking criteria for giving out their grants. So as we go through all of our process of what we think you need to do to be sustainable, it's pretty much concurrent with EPA. They've pretty much taken what we've done over the years and incorporated it into their grant. So their thinking is when they've got such a small amount of money that they try to select people who have pretty much laid out this whole program plan that will provide a sustainable program. So the objective of what we're doing, we have two things. One is, and I'll let Glo explain this in a second, an annual grantee meeting. And then we also have these biweekly, every other week, just quick 30-minute phone calls discussing whatever topics people would like to do. And today, Lena has agreed to talk to us about Hunter's Point, which is an exciting program. Hunter's Point has gone on for over a dozen years. I was out there probably 10 years ago with big hopes of job training and redevelopment, and after Glo tells us about events in Washington and what's going on with the annual meeting, we're going to turn it over to Lena and let her talk to us about Hunter's Point, what it is, how they coalesced a group to develop a community job development training program, and how they were successful in getting their grant this cycle. So with that, why don't we... Why don't we turn it over to Glo. Glo, you want to give us two things, one on any updates on Washington and then also anything news about this annual meeting that's going to be occurring?
Well, the only updates I have from Washington have to do with the grantee meeting, actually. Nothing as far as the next RFP release or anything like that. But I did hear this week that Maddie Stanislaw, who's the assistant administrator of the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, was going to be able to attend our meeting this year, which is good. He was there a couple years ago was not able to attend last year because he had another conference that he had to attend, but he will be at this year's conference. He will be speaking on Monday evening along with Gail Cooper, who's the Deputy Director for the Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization. So we're excited to have them. The other thing that I found out this week was that EPA's attorney, who used to give a presentation on the legal issues of having a brownfields grant, retired at the end of August, and they have someone that has taken his place, and she will be giving a presentation at the grantee meeting again this year, along with someone from the Office of Grants and Debarment, which is good. So then you're going to get two sides of the issue. Basically, those are the main things that are new this week. But the grantee meeting has come along good. We have 94 people registered. Some of the people on the call today, in fact, are registered. And I'm working on the agenda now. It will be going out in draft form, I'm hoping, next week.
Okay. One of the things that when we talk to EPA, we encourage, we suggest to the EPA that communities that want to start programs, it would be beneficial for them to attend this conference. And they said, of course, if they can get there and they're interested in starting a community program, it might be a good idea because they'll be immersed in a group of grantees who have been, some have been here for 10 years, some have had successful programs and are not funded anymore by EPA, are off on their own getting state funding and foundation funding. Some that will be there have chosen not to continue with EPA funding with the understanding in their minds that it's high-hanging fruit. It's money that if you get, it's not that easy to implement. They're asking a lot for a little, and there are people who would say, there are people who said this is great seed money and it's wonderful and got our program started, and almost everyone will agree with that. After that, it kind of breaks off into two groups, those who say we weren't able to sustain it because we couldn't get any additional funding from someone else. Others will say we got more funding than we need and we don't need EPA anymore. And there's a couple of grantees that will be there that will basically talk about what happened, that they just, they're so well funded they really don't need the EPA money. So and the reporting and everything that goes along with it. So you'll get a good round out of in breakout sessions of all kinds of issues there. Now, GLO, the deadline has passed, though, hasn't it, for housing?
Yeah, the deadline was last Friday. I have been able to get a few people in at the group rate, so, you know, we'll certainly keep trying. The more we can get in, the better it'll be. And so if anybody registers late, go through me first, and we will work with the hotel together to try to get you in there.
Okay, and you want to give everyone your phone number in case that...
563-441-4081.
Okay, that takes care of our announcements for right now. What we wanted to do today, and I've always been impressed with the Hunters Point family, it's a great organization, and I asked Lena if she could tell us a little bit about Hunters Point, how you got started, where you're at, and maybe a little bit about where you're located. Lena?
Thank you, Mike. Let me see. So tell me about how many minutes you want me to talk so I know whether, you know, how condensed to make it short.
Well, we have until 2:30 Eastern, so about 20 minutes. And I would just say lead us along of where you're at and who you're near and some of the problems you've had and how you got started and decided to. I'm asking you guys for a three-hour session in about 20 minutes. we'll break in.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So View Hunters Point is in San Francisco, the southeast section. It's right on the water. The way the community kind of developed that during the World War II, that Hunters Point was a shipyard, and they needed people to work out on the shipyard, and so they did heavy recruitment in the southern states. So, you know, particularly Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas, stuff like that, to bring African Americans to San Francisco to work in the shipyards. And these jobs were really well-paying jobs, a lot of people, and it created a large African American class. And so, and but the, you know, kind of as always with everybody, you know, people who are going to make the most of the opportunity, and then there's people who are going to struggle financially. So you also had the temporary barracks that were set up kind of military style, same type of design you see CDO in other military areas in San Francisco. And those became, then that was a temporary housing for the people who had just come from down south and needed places to stay. And they to be temporary. Those became public housing in San Francisco and the main public housing elements that are still there and that people have been living in for the last 60 years. So a lot, like I said, they were set up to be temporary and they have many, many problems with the plumbing and stuff. But most importantly is that also where the city, because that was the large, that was the area that was largely populated with low-income African Americans, you know, relative to the rest of the San Francisco population, that it like the pattern in every city across America, that the city decided to put everything that was undesirable and unhealthy in that community because nobody else would have it in theirs. And, you know, it just, that's just kind of how things go, but so the power plant was located there, of course, where they would dump battery acid. They, you know, the ships that brought the planes over to Nagasaki and Hiroshima and dropped the bombs and had all the radioactivity. They brought them there. They sandblasted them there. And, I mean, you name it. They said that everything is in that shipyard, which is why we have the federal designation to have two federal Superfund sites in that area. In addition, we have 130 other brownfield sites there in this one little small area. Now, remember, San Francisco was only 15 by 15 square miles, so this is even a smaller area of it. So you have all these toxins and pollutants condensed. And then you have the sewer. They decided to put the sewer there right in the residential area. And that processed the sewage for two cities that are suburbs of San Francisco and 80% of San Francisco sewage. And, you know, it stinks and everything else. The city's dump is there, wrecking yards, heavy industrial zoning, you name it, we got it. And so this is made also what this is reflected in our health statistics. So we have some of the worst health statistics in the country with asthma, with cancer, with skin diseases. And then on top of that, we have the social issue. So I think like 80% of the folks that live in public housing in San Francisco are living below federal poverty level. Now, take that into account that San Francisco is the most expensive place to live in the world. It has passed even Japan. You know, that, those statistics may have changed in the last few years, but that has been one that's been a while around for a while. So when you look at the disparity in education, when you look at the disparity in income level, when you look at the level of homicide, mental health, substance abuse, you look at every single social and economic indicator. The people in the community are at some of the bottom of in the country in terms of how these things have impacted all of these different areas that lead up to quality of life. And so, you know, you can make that connection. It's kind of like we're dealing with some heavy, you know, despair in that community and pain and a sense of hopelessness and have been for a long time because all these things have been going on at once. And now it's interesting we wake up and we're in the middle of one of the worst economic recessions that anyone who's our age range can even remember. And there is money flowing like the river in Bayview Hunters Point because we have a number of development projects. You know, the land has, they see Bayview Hunters Point as the last land to be developed in this very small city, the most sought-after place to live in the world. And the place that they're looking at is Bayview Hunters Point, and they have had plans for quite a while to make it a yacht harbor and everything else. So then, of course, you have people coming in to develop the land. You have to improve the sewer. So we have a $6.9 billion wastewater treatment project going on, which is one of the largest in San Francisco's history, which is the sewer that's in Bayview Hunters Point that's connected to the community college. And it's, so there's very interesting dynamics. Now, all of these community benefits packages say that the people who've been historically impacted by all of these things should benefit from these things, and that this money for community benefits should be invested in jobs for people, better quality of life, you know, affordable housing. But what we're finding is it seems to bypass us every time. And so that the development is, where, you know, everyone in the community is very clear. It's not for the people who live there now. And there is no sort of compensation for all the things that have gone on. So, but that doesn't mean that that has to be our reality. And that's kind of where the EPA thing came in, and us really understanding that opportunity, because the bottom line is that we've been, you know, poisoned for decades now, and having an awareness and consciousness about that, and also of what the opportunity is, really trying to transform that reality that we're living in, if there is a straw of hope. And this has been our straw of hope, because we found people who are the federal government who are saying, we recognize that this is happening and it's not okay, and we want to support you all to take control of what's happening in your community, and to really transform it for the better. So for us, you know, this is, you know, here on this level, it's a great opportunity because there's a lot of well-paid work for cleanup, and there's a market for it now because of all these different development projects. But it's also very symbolic because it's us training our young people how to clean up this mess and to understand that the future, not only of Bayview Hunters Point, but the whole planet right now, is that we all need to start training our young people how to really, really think about how to make this planet healthier and us in turn with that. So that we heard about the EPA grant. People have been telling me, and folks from EPA have been very, very friendly towards us and welcoming and trying to explain to us that there were opportunities and encouraging us to apply. And this was kind of weird to me, too, because I've never really had people who were, welcoming about applying or asking for funds for things. Things have really closed off recently in terms of the foundation world and the city, and everything has just, you know, just been a little harder. So that was the first interesting thing. And then they had all these resources, like these phone calls, where I was really able to learn what was going on and how this process worked, and what was important to the proposal, what they were really looking at, what we could expect. And that really shaped my thinking about what we needed to do to be successful for this grant. And most importantly was that it had to lead to jobs, and that, you know, these certificates would help people to get work in all these different development projects. And so my job was to connect all these things. So first thing I had to do was make a blueprint for where all the work was and get from them what their projected work projections were, and get them to make a commitment that they would hire our folks if they had all the right certifications and everything else, and then give that to us in a letter. And, you know, it happened, which I was really surprised about, because it doesn't seem like things have been moving real smooth. But I think it was just kind of the my different understanding and connection to different people who were doing this that changed my thinking and the way I dealt with it, and then our opportunity to have this happen. So this is what everyone is talking about in Bayview Hunters Point now is that, I mean, we're talking about thousands of jobs, well-paid jobs, are going to be coming up with the construction, the engineering, the whole Hetch Hetchy thing that's going on. So this is our entire water infrastructure that is currently being redone, which is just one of the projects. So it's how, you know, there's enough work out there for all of our people and for all of our people to live well for the next 20 years. But the whole catch is that the last 40, or no, not 40, the last 25 years have been so devastating to our community that, you know, now you have multiple barriers, you know, in terms of real ones about your life, whether, you know, what if you still have a license, did you get your GED, did you ever go to jail, all these kinds of things. And then you also have mental barriers, which is a lot of people have kind of just become hopeless, you know, about life and have adopted a mentality and behaviors that reflect that sense of hopelessness and that no matter what you do, things are just going to be a disaster, so you might as well just kind of get whatever sweetness you can out of life right then and there. So, I mean, we're dealing with a lot of stuff, and for us, you know, we're hopeful about our young people getting jobs and stuff like that, and we're excited about the possibility that this may be the beginning of how we learn how to move in all of this opportunity. And let me say, this is not just our organization saying, can we take advantage of it? I mean, every workforce development agency in Bayview Hunters Point over the last 10 years has been wiped clean. Nobody is putting people to work. For many reasons, but anyway. So, you know, like I said, we're all looking at this. Everyone who's in the community, all the workforce development people, the city, some of the city people, you know, anyone who's interested in what's going to happen to the primarily African-American community that's left in Bayview, Hunters Point, and are trying to figure this out. So we've pulled in other people, community-based organizations, the city, into the grant as our partners. And so that way everyone can learn this together and we can all get better together, and that we can also we can develop these relationships with these developers and stuff like that. We have the backing of the EPA. You know, people know that, so they begin to deal with you a little differently. We have real things to offer. These certifications are, you know, worth so much to the population that we serve, and they value it highly and are really looking for it. So, I mean, that's kind of the essence of what our story is and how we came into this grant and what we're trying to do with it. Is that okay, Mike?
That is awesome. And, you know, there is absolutely no question that you've got the need and you've got the demographics and you've got the best real estate in the country right now. But you also had to get past the grant proposal process. And, of course, this is very objective. They grade point by point. And interestingly enough, and I think what we're going to do probably in the next discussion is talk about those points. In other words, it's one thing to have the need, and everyone knows, and your community is very similar to in Camden, for example. They had the exact same situation. In their case, it wasn't a bay, it was a riverfront, and they had billions of dollars going into casinos and waterfront hotels, and they had one of the highest rates of suicide and murder in the teen population in the country. And very mirrored your situation very similar, but to different extents all over the country there are communities like this. And the question is the need is there, but now how do we convince the people in Washington to fund this and to get this program started? And we're going to want to focus on what you did in partnering. And you did some really smart things early on. You did the blueprint. We call it a needs assessment, where you went out right away and said, okay, you know, there's a lot of construction, there's wastewater plants going in. Are there jobs? And, of course, everyone's saying, yeah, there's jobs. But you were very smart in, okay, can you write us a letter? Not that you're absolutely going to hire, but that you're going to look at our graduates if we graduate them. And then you got them to agree. And that was, I think, very instrumental in that proposal process that you were selected. A lot of things that and we'll talk about later, but you had an uphill battle going into this because you've got another job training program, what, 30 miles away, Archangst program, up in on the other side of the bay.
Yeah, and, and they're putting their people to work out in San Francisco, and we can't get a job.
That's right.
Yeah, and it is. But I knew to do that because that's listening on the phone calls and, you know, talking to folks and looking at old proposals and stuff like that. That's what I saw. That was a standard. But I wouldn't have thought of that if that wasn't. And so by making me do those things, that made it that much stronger for our relationship with these employers and, you know, all of that. So I'm saying the whole process reinforced itself. All I really did was I looked at what you guys or what the EPA was looking for, and what they wanted to see was they wanted to see that these certifications are expensive. Now, if we invest $4,000, whatever it ends up costing per person, we want to make sure that these people get jobs, not just another training program where everyone is moralized at the end, which we see endlessly, but that these things lead to jobs. So it was very clear to us from the beginning, you're not going to even get the grant if you don't have any place for these people to go to work. And not just sitting around saying, oh, well, there's this work going on, they better hire people, but, you know, really developing a relationship so this thing is cemented, you know, and they can't get out of it. So the EPA is saying, okay, this is real. And we can see how by linking these things together, this is a real plan. This can really work. And what I saw by just going over the RFP again and again, listening to these phone calls, was all the pieces began to, like, light up in my head and all the connections. And, so I was able to just link all of those connections in that way, because we want our people to go to work, and they make you have a minimum of 80% of the people that you train need to go to work. So when you think about that, you know, you have to get real serious about how am I going to actually make this happen, you know. And then I think it inspires you just to start thinking of all the resources that are out there and all the pieces that need to be connected and stuff like that. And we had to get real political. I mean, you know, that's all a part of it. It's about relationships. It's about being able to call people. It's about being able to push what it is, people being able to trust you enough, like the city, you know, and these developers to give you a letter, because nobody wants to put anything in writing. So it was really establishing the relationship, and, you know, just we had to work it in every way.
Does anyone have any questions of Lena on this call? She's demonstrated this need, and in future sessions, and the next one will be in 2 weeks, we're going to talk about a lot of people have the need, but now the trick is translating that need into a fundable program. And obviously you were able to very distinctly, and most people that don't get the funding the first time, they know they had the need, and they know everyone thinks they should have the need, but they really are not able to express it in the format and the objective way they grade it. And it's not fair the way they do it. It would be nice if they could get everyone into a room and say, let's look at these communities and let's judge who's the most worthy or who's going to get the best program. But unfortunately, we've got contractors, they've got contractors reviewing them, they've got outsiders reviewing these. So they have to come up with some grading system, and it's not really fair. Many of the best proposals don't get funded the first time because they haven't necessarily addressed exactly the right issues and hit the spot. So and we're going to talk about that in a future time. But does anyone on the call today have any questions of Lena while we have her on right now?
Yeah, this is Autumn in Anchorage, Alaska, and I just was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you broke through some of those barriers with, like, the education and incarceration and, like, the mental barriers that your community had.
Well, I don't think it's a done thing yet. We just got the grant, so, you know, we haven't even – we're just in the planning phase yet in terms of, in general, how we – do it is, I mean, you know, hey, there's no magic bullet. You just got to, one, this is our community. We love our community. You know, many of them are our family members, our extended family members, friends of, you know, so there's a natural kind of love and care. And then there's also the professional aspect, like Melody Daniel, who's on this call, who's the director of our workforce development agency, has a master's degree in family and therapy, you know, family child therapy counseling, whatever the right term is. But, you know, and taking that kind of thinking and applying it to what's going on in our community and really tailoring all our work in our case management into understanding that there's, you know, deeper issues, deeper pain, and you just got to kind of be with a person. And you use best practices, of course, but it's also your intention. So, you know, I'm not saying anything that you don't already know. Now, there's the jail thing, and that's the barrier. So we have barrier removal money. We can try to get their records sealed. We can help them with driver's license issues and stuff like that. So we do have some money through a city contract to do that for people. So
we're at our annual conference. We're going to have a session on working with disenfranchised populations, ex-offenders, disabled, and disparitable issues, just as you described. This is an important topic that everyone's wrestling with, because when you have people in the class who may be at one level and other people at a different level, it affects the recruitment process. It affects the what type of rehabilitation training you might need to get people up to a certain level. It has implications to the instructors of not teaching the lowest common denominator. So these are some pedagogical issues that we're going to be having to discuss, because they are major, and this work is not easy. It's difficult work, and we're going to continue to talk about some of these issues as we go along. Well, listen, Lena, I really appreciate you describing what's going on there. And we can limit this to 30 minutes. So in future calls, we're going to talk about the next step of, once you identify the need, which you have well identified, how do we get that? How do we translate that need now into a working, sustainable plan in terms of addressing these issues and putting the proper practices in place to keep a sustainable program going. So with that, we'll write some post-session notes on this. And again, keep up the good work up there. And we'll hopefully talk to you all in 2 weeks, and we'll continue this discussion. So thanks for tuning in today.
Thanks, everybody.
We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.
Thank you.
Bye.